You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job posts seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/ARTS. Just go to Indeed.com/ARTS right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Hi, folks. Welcome along to Soundtracking with me, Edith Bowman. Welcome along to another episode of my dive into the creative minds of those involved in the wonderful things that entertain us on the small and the big screen. If you are joining us for the first time, welcome along. It's a pleasure to have you. What we try and do every week is just have a bit of a conversation about music and film. Sometimes there can be a tiny little bit of that. Sometimes there could be loads of it. It kind of depends on who our guest is. But we try and not restrict things, to be honest, because we're more interested in the people and their stories rather than them fitting into some kind of framework. So I hope you enjoy it. And if you are a regular listener, thank you so much from the bottom of our heart for your support. And we appreciate you taking the time to listen to us. I'm really, really super excited about our guest this week. I've been a big fan of his for a while. He's terrified me. He has intrigued me. And I am always excited and really kind of filled with anticipation about how I'm going to feel when I come out of his next film. He kind of does his own version of dramatic horror. It's not even horror and it's not just drama. It's so many things. Ari Aster, he's such a visionary when it comes to storytelling. He, for me anyway, I feel that he is a huge fan of character, performance, environment, feeling and music as well. It's so evident in all of his films. And I'm so excited that he is here to talk about his latest film, Eddington, which he wrote and directed. It stars Joaquin Phoenix, Pedro Pascal, Emma Stone, Austin Butler, amongst many others. And it tells the story of, well, it's really interesting because my take on it, and I don't want to go into too much detail about it. So Joaquin Phoenix plays the sheriff of Eddington. Pedro Pascal plays the mayor, and Emma Stone is the partner of Joaquin Phoenix. And it's just as COVID is starting to really hit and we're being forced to wear masks and restrictions are coming in. And it's how things escalate within the minds of people, within the community of people. It's a look at social media, the escalation of things, really. It's so fascinating. It's very funny. And it's kind of one of those funny things that you're like, I'm not sure I should be laughing at this, but I find it absolutely brilliant. And I think it's such an interesting take on COVID, not on the kind of grand scale of a pandemic, but how it can, how it affected small communities and individuals within those communities, and how it can be so different. And with each individual within that community, how it kind of affected them so uniquely to themselves, but how it almost kind of bled into things within them that they were holding down or were scared to talk about, almost kind of gave them the ammunition to allow that to bubble to the surface. It's fascinating. Now, it's scored by Daniel Pemberton and Bobby Krillick, and so we're going to begin with their cue, We Draw Guns.
Thank you.
huge congratulations.
Thank you. Thanks very much.
And I know that it's been, or elements of it have been something that have been with you for a while, a kind of, you know, a version of this story is something that you wanted to tell way back at the start, if that's right. And it's, you know, and then it's obviously taken slightly different form to tell it in its form in the way that you've told Eddington now for us.
Yeah, well, I guess its first iteration had very little to do with the film that is out now. But I grew up in New Mexico. I'm from New Mexico, and I always wanted to make a movie that was set there. And I had written a contemporary Western that was about feuding locals in a small town. And that's really the only thing that carried over. I tried to make it as my first film. It didn't really work that way. Couldn't get it made. And then at the end of May, early June 2020, I just found that I really wanted to make a movie about what was happening in the world, specifically in America. And that framework was just sort of there waiting, I guess, for me to come back to it and hang all of this stuff on it.
It was so interesting watching the film today in kind of hindsight to that whole time period that the world went through. You know, even though you wanted it to be particular to that place, that time in the States, there's obviously so much that people can kind of relate to, or the tone of the film is incredible in terms of how there's times that you find yourself just really laughing out loud at things and reactions to things and going, oh my God, I remember seeing someone diving into that whole conspiracy thing. And you relate to so much that's going on in the film. It's really, really clever.
Oh, well, thank you. I mean, you know, it was important to me that the film not just reflect the absurdity of the moment, but really actually be kind of possessed by it. And so it should be funny. Although I hope that the laughs catch in the throat, because it's also not funny. It's not
what it's scary, it's tragic, it's all those things as well. Absolutely.
Yeah. What it's talking about is no laughing matter. But I think that's the insidious thing about this moment, is that it's horrible and dangerous and catastrophic and scary. And yet at the same time, it's everything is sort of impossible to take seriously and absurd and ridiculous. And so it's just a very, very difficult moment to get your hands around, especially because nothing lasts, nothing sticks. Everybody is talking about everything all the time.
Yeah, that's what I feel like you've captured so brilliantly, is that it is almost that kind of thing where if you glance at any kind of social media site and you say you flick through half a dozen stories, they could cover half a dozen subject matters that go from there to there to there to there and everything in between. That the seriousness of them, how they can affect culture, race, so many areas of life. And you've managed, I feel, to kind of capture that in the film in a way that all these kind of different characters are so almost kind of driven by a moment or a reaction or something they think they are passionate about or believe and don't know how to react to it. It's just so, it's amazing how you make us think about so many different things in the way that these characters react to all those different things. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you. All the characters are sort of, they're all siloed off from each other and they're living in these bubbles of certainty, the way that we all are.
Yeah.
And they're all kind of gripped by this dread and this feeling that something is really terribly wrong, but none of them agree on what that thing is. Mm-hmm. They're all looking at the world through different windows.
And, yeah.
Yeah.
Music. You know, the idea that we could talk about your films and your clear kind of like connection with music and how important music is in your filmmaking would be impossible in the time that we've got. But in this, there's some really lovely specific moments to talk about, and the score as a whole I feel has got a real kind of Hitchcockian kind of feel to it in a way, and those kind of, whether it's the sort of the wood sticks kind of sort of, you know, that kind of rhythm that we hear from those, or the wind instruments, or the kind of almost real sort of Bernard Herrmann moments that kind of really go there with the kind of orchestra sound, or Katy Perry blasting from a scene, you know, there's some really brilliant music moments. When does music come into your creative process, you know, in terms of when you're writing the script? Are you thinking about music? Are you writing with music in mind? You know, when is it starting to sort of form a kind of thought process for you with around the film and characters and narrative?
Sometimes I'm thinking about music in the writing process. My first two films, that was definitely the case. I was listening to a lot of Colin Stetson when I was writing Hereditary, and the same thing was the case for Midsommar. During the writing process, I was listening to The Hacks and Cloak. And so in both cases, I was able to end up working with those artists on the scores for those films, which was really great. And I would say their music felt to me just like the worlds of the films that were in my head.
That's really interesting, yeah.
Yeah, I found that they were both very useful, like touchstones, but also it was just like an atmosphere I wanted to live in while I was writing. I can't say that for my last two films. I kind of was lost on what their musical identities would be. When I was editing Bo and Eddington, we were experimenting with a lot of music because we didn't really know tonally what would be right, especially for Bo is Afraid, which is such a tonal experiment as it is. Sometimes it's like a Rube Goldberg machine, or like a or like a
It's
like
almost
the
moments that are like Birdman in a way, the drive and the pace of kind of moments within it sort of thing, the
yeah
rhythm
it's
almost of.
propulsive yeah it's propulsive and it but then it also slows down. It's like it's almost like a Tex Avery cartoon in the beginning, but then by the end it's something much more melancholic and heartbroken. And so that was tricky, but I had such a great experience with Bobby that I decided to try it again with him. By the way, I had an amazing time with Colin as well, and I just haven't had the chance to go back to him yet because he has such a specific sound, and I tend to only want him to do his thing with his like fucked up saxophones. But I'm kind of de I'm desperate to go back to him because I really loved that experience. But I went to Bobby on Bow, and that was a hard one to find for both of us. It took a lot of experimentation, whereas Midsommar came together really quickly. Like we were in a room together, and that score kind of came together in like 2 weeks, whereas that's not the case for Bow, which took a long, long time. And I'm so happy with where we landed on that. And then with Eddington, I just knew early on that I wanted something that would be kind of schizophrenic, something that would be kind of classical and old-fashioned, and then something that would almost be futuristic and off, like and wrong feeling. And so the idea kind of came to have two composers working on it, which was a tricky thing to like mediate and figure out how to do that. And you know, there are a lot of cues that there were like two versions of, and sometimes we Frankenstein them,
Awesome.
but for the most part I had to choose between them. And you really need to think about cohesion when you're making these scores, and you make sure that the whole thing feels unified. And so you know, you kind of have to choose one person's theme. It was tricky, but I worked with Daniel Pemberton and Bobby Krylik again. And they both did really amazing work. And yeah, I'm really proud of it. I love the score.
Yeah, it's really interesting actually. I just spoke to David Fleming and John Murphy, who worked together but separately on the Superman score as well, you know, in terms of having two composers on that. And you know, watching the film today, I really try and kind of not cloud too much information going in to watch the film. I want to go into the theater and I want to experience it. So I'm like I don't want to know who's done what sort of thing. So I didn't know going in to watch the film today that both Bobby and Daniel had done the scores. And so I would never have known that two different composers had worked on things. So like when you're talking about the idea that making things cohesive and stuff, it absolutely kind of does. But like you say, there is a real journey with different elements of the score. And I was just interested as to how that worked and how you asked them to work on that, I guess.
Well, they worked separately. I worked with both of them a lot. So I was in the room with both of them for, I would say, a majority of the scoring process. And I had never done that before, working with two composers. And it, you know, there were kind of growing pains, and then sometimes you'd realize, oh shit, in the name of cohesion, this one cue, which I love, won't work because we need to kind of like imbue this with the DNA of what we've just like already established from this other artist's. And so there was a lot of experimentation. And again, there are a couple cues that, you know, like maybe that were primarily Bobby's. And then because we needed to bring part of Daniel's theme in, there will be like maybe one or two elements that are playing all the way through that, but it's him kind of breaking in, and vice versa, where maybe you'll have a piece by Daniel and then Bobby's music will start kind of like swelling up. It's really tricky. I mean, it's hard to describe here just because it was, you know, a process of months and months and months.
I'm really looking forward to listening to the score as a collection of music. Do you know what I mean? Because I feel like it's so kind of rich and like you say, kind of there's a lot in there as well. I wanted to ask as well about things. There are those kind of little moments that I mentioned, like even the Pedro's character's advert with the kind of the theme on that with the piano when he's got the little, that's kind of fun, you know, kind of within the film of going, okay, write me a really, the idea of kind of go away and write me a really cheesy piano piece for an advert for Pedro's. That's a fun ask.
Yeah. No, it was a real joy. We had, I guess, some references, like Morricone was definitely on our mind, and like Aaron Copland. Yeah. And
even a little bit at the end that I felt, sorry, I just totally interrupted you, but which feels a bit like the cavatina from The Deer Hunter right at the end.
Well, that's I cannot tell a lie, that was definitely the inspiration for that guitar piece.
Yes,
that's exactly right. You nailed it.
Awesome. Do you play? Are you musical at all?
No, I don't. My father is a jazz drummer.
Oh, wow.
Who used to be an R&B drummer. He played with the OJs for a little while.
Wow.
Yeah.
So you've been surrounded by rhythm then?
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess that was like my rebellion, that I never took up an instrument.
I love that. I've written down really badly, obviously, because I just saw the film today. Trying to write in the dark's really tricky, and also trying to not interrupt watching the film by writing a few things down. But there were a couple of kind of little specific cues, if you don't mind, just kind of I wanted to pick up on, if that's all right. When Emma's character leaves, God, you feel it. You feel that kind of, that was like, just really stood out for me as a kind of specific little cue. And I wondered if you, specifically talking around that combination of writing music for characters and the emotion around those specific scenes as well, or the shift in the arc and the change in characters as well, and how the music either follows that or doesn't.
That was a very tricky scene, and I kept trying different things with both Bobby and Daniel for a while, and we could never get it right because you'd either be leaning too much on like the pathos there and it became like treacly, or I would have them do something kind of eerie and kind of discordant, and then it just became weird and dark and kind of just oppressive. And so for a while, we just kind of decided to have nothing there, which also just felt like not enough. It was either too much or not enough. And it was at the very end of the process that I reached out to Daniel and just said, can you just go to your piano and just like hit different keys like really hard? Like I just need piercing. Just let it ring out. Yeah, and then he sent me a bunch of different things to play with, and so that ended up being what felt right. Just this feeling of like,
Stab in the heart.
she's leaving, like, and yeah, he's being stabbed in the heart. That's exactly right.
It is those reverberations that you mention are so effective of letting the note hang. Really impactful. Stay cool, stay together, Q.
Yeah.
The ring light's just
That's right. Where he goes into the, he's going into the eye of the storm,
with a ring light.
with a ring light as his weapon, and with Guy and his SWAT gear. That was fun. That is one example of a Frankenstein that is mostly Bobby's music, but where Daniel's theme comes in on horns. And the idea was just, yeah, it's they're cowboys that are like riding in. I think what I said was, yeah, they're catching wild horses. But the idea was there needs to be some sense of like adventure and danger here. And it's obviously the music is kind of used ironically. That's one of the scenes where the tone is like the trickiest and where the tongue is in the cheek. And you're really joined to the subjectivity of those officers, well, deputies and sheriff, rather.
I mean, the performances in the film are fantastic. Joaquin is just outstanding.
Yeah, he's great.
Sometimes it's the scenes where it's just his physicality, and even after that scene where he goes into the Mexican restaurant to kind of, to make his to do his presentation, and he just the way under his breath, he's kind of like, I was expecting a better turnout, kind of thing, that those kind of things. From that to the tenderness with Emma's character when they're in bed, to that kind of final chase scene as well. It's just an actor given the opportunity to just do everything really in one role. I can't imagine how you shot that end chase sequence and that 360 where you go all the way around him, where he's kind of, you know, and that sound that he, I imagine that was a conversation in terms of what that kind of asthmatic, the adrenaline, the running, trying to breathe kind of thing. It's so effective in the theatre where you, that's all you hear. And you're with him and those, you know, those points of view that we see on that shot as well. It's so effective. And kind of choosing to have music in that, you know, in that kind of end chase scene as well or not, and where you would bring it in. And because it feels like there's not a lot of music in that at all.
There is music for, I would say, the first two thirds of that. I'm not sure if you'd even call it a
sequence. What would you call it?
Well, it's multiple sequences. Mm. You know, there's the scene in the desert with, this is sort of a spoiler, but with the explosion, and then he goes home, and then there's the action scene that moves him down into the valley and up the hill, and then he's in town. And so if we're going to call that all kind of one, let's call it a string of sequences.
Yeah.
The last third of that has no music, and there is pretty propulsive or at least ambient music peppering all of it before that. And so, you know, you want it to be, you want the music to be either propulsive in a way or reactive so that it's never separate from anything you're seeing on screen. You want it to be like kind of in the bones of the movie. And so it's good if you didn't even notice the music happening. And there are ambient stretches where that's definitely where it should be almost subliminal. And then there's, you know, when he's running into the valley and when he's going up the hill, you got like taiko drums and all that stuff.
Yeah.
But then when he ends up in the town, I took away all the music and pretty much the only thing on the soundtrack besides gunshots when they actually sound is Joaquin's breathing. And that was by design. I knew that was only going to be Joaquin's breathing. We experimented with taking all the music out. It was just a little bit better with music. So before that,
I have to talk about the fundraiser scene as well, because it's a brilliant scene with Katy Perry blasting and just the kind of like the childlike nature of pulling the volume down, and just the way that you have that shot of the mixer and then being pulled down and put back up. It's brilliant. Why Katy Perry, Ari?
Well, I'm going to be honest with you.
Yeah.
The first song that I was using for a long, long time and which we tried to get was Jay-Z and Alicia Keys' Empire State of Mind. Yeah, which I found so funny, and it felt like exactly what Ted Garcia, the Pedro Pascal character, would be playing at his fundraiser. This New York anthem out in the middle
desert.
Of nowhere. Yeah, which is like too old. It's like not, it's like, you know, even in, you know, the film is set 5 years ago, but even in 2020, that would have been the, you know, just the wrong. And so that, I was really on a mission to secure that. And we, I think Jay-Z was going through something or he was busy and just, we couldn't get him to watch it. So it was never turned down. It just we couldn't get a response. And so I finally, you know, about a month and a half before we had to put our pencils down, just had to go through every song imaginable that felt like it was tied to the culture in the right way. You know, we put hundreds of songs up against that scene, and Katy Perry's Firework was far and away the best.
It really works.
It really works. It also has a lot of bass. And that's a scene where I pushed the bass about as far as we possibly could, which really like makes you queasy and your chest and your stomach. That's really important for the scene because Joaquin's character is about to crack.
Yeah. The slap.
The slap, exactly.
Slap. And the glasses. His reaction in that's amazing.
Yeah. And I feel like pushing that bass and having you feel kind of sick because it's all just too much puts you in his experience in a way that really works. I'm really, really happy with that sequence.
As you should. Before we run out of time, one of the many things I love about your films and how they make you feel is down to location as well, and how it feels like you're really committed to taking us into the worlds and taking us so that we feel like we're there. So we feel the atmosphere, we feel the tension, we feel the emotion that's going on wherever we are. And that's, you know, everything from, you know, around that maypole or to the desert, and even that scene in Beau's Afraid, you know, when he's running into the grocery store, you're kind of like, you feel like you're dodging all those kind of people and things as he's kind of doing that. Is that something that's incredibly important to you in terms of creating or having those locations that are as real and tangible for your cast as they are for you and your creatives?
Absolutely. Production design is, and costume design, all these things that amount to the texture of the film, and they're everything. And but something like Beau is Afraid is a very different story because that's an invented world. And so in that grocery store and all over that neighborhood or wherever we are in the film, everything you see is made up, including the products on the shelves, the water that he's going into that grocery store for. We made that brand of water. And, you know, the movie posters, there's so many movie posters in Beau is Afraid, or all the shops in that neighborhood have veneers that we made up for that world. Eddington was meant to really feel like New Mexico. First of all, it's the first film I've ever shot that is all on location. There are a few buildings that we had to completely redo, like the sheriff's office and Ted's bar. But otherwise, we were limited by whatever space we were in. And I'm somebody who really likes to build sets on stages, and it gives me a lot of freedom. And that's something that I didn't have here, which was really good for this film. But then, you know, there are still a lot of veneers in the town that have silly names, you know. So there is still some invention here, but we had a very, very clear template, right? It was New Mexico. And Truth or Consequences is such a specific place, which is where we shot most of the town of Eddington. And for us, it was just about using what was there as much as we could, kind of making it even more itself, if that makes sense.
Well, it feels like a character. That's the thing. That's what I mean. It feels kind of so kind of real. We feel like we're in it. So yeah, absolutely. Ari, thank you so much for your time. I've really loved chatting to you. Huge congratulations on the film. And for, you know, for everything that you've given us, the stories that you've given to us, I very much look forward to diving back into Eddington as well for my second visit, because it's going to feel like it's the gift that's going to keep on giving as well. Great to chat to you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Great talking to you.
To Eddington, that's Daniel Pemberton's main theme, rounding off this latest episode of Soundtracking with the wonderful Ari Aster. My huge thanks to Ari for taking the time to talk to us. Eddington is on general release now, so do get along to the cinema to see it if you can. Go with some mates, because the wonderful thing that I think the film will do will kind of really spark conversation when you come out the cinema. I've loved speaking to Daniel Pemberton on the podcast several occasions, actually, and you can find those chats at edithbowman.com, along with every other single episode of the podcast. I am in the process of trying to catch up with Bobby Krillick. If you aren't already, we've got lots of lovely ways that you can kind of keep an eye on what we're doing as well as other things. So our socials, we're at Soundtracking UK, where we have clips and teasers and news and giveaways. And we've also got a YouTube channel called Soundtracking Extra, where we sometimes have exclusive content up there. We've got loads of that up there. So please go and subscribe and follow us if you aren't already. We've got loads of great episodes coming up over the coming weeks. Eric Idle, who I had the absolute pleasure of chatting to this week about an upcoming live show that he has that starts on the 10th of September. He's going all over the UK. So if you fancy going along to see him live, then check out details where he's going to be playing. Just head to his website. It's all up there. Chris Columbus, who I last had on the podcast with Robert Eggers, because he was a producer on Nosferatu. He has directed Thursday Murder Club, that is up on Netflix as of the end of this week, actually. So go and check it out and then join me back here in a couple of weeks to hear my chat with Chris Columbus, where he also gives a fascinating insight into some pretty iconic films that he is touted as kind of pushing forward, not least Gremlins 3 and a Goonies sequel. I know, how exciting is that? Also looking forward to getting Paul Thomas Anderson back on the podcast to talk about his new film, One Battle After Another. So loads of great stuff on the way. So if you aren't already subscribed to the podcast, then please do. But next up, talking about his new film, Caught Stealing, Darren Aronofsky returns to Soundtracking to discuss his new film. I very much look forward to the pleasure of your company then.